In response to the tragic death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, President Trump has vowed to make a nomination to fill her seat nearly immediately, unleashing enormous controversy in Washington just weeks before the 2020 election. Find out more from former U.S. Senator Heidi Heitkamp on this episode of The War Room at American Bridge. Welcome back to the War Room at American Bridge podcast. I'm David Brock, co-founder of American Bridge 21st Century. Today, we're going to discuss the Supreme Court battle currently taking place in the wake of the unfortunate death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. With me today is former U.S. Senator Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota. Senator, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, David. Really appreciate the opportunity to talk to your listeners. And I must say, I really appreciate all the great work American Bridge is doing, especially in rural America. Congratulations. You guys are really making an impact.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And thanks for being with us today. So I'm going to start on Ruth Bader Ginsburg's legacy, because it seems like, at least from the Washington media, it's gotten a little short shrift in the political maelstrom that started with Mitch McConnell virtually immediately announcing his plans. So let's start with the legacy. And I wanted to just ask on a more personal note, what does she and her legacy mean to you? And your thoughts on her legacy more broadly?
I think, you know, it's so interesting because when you think of somebody like Thurgood Marshall or John Lewis, you think of those people who were champions of the civil rights movement and honestly feminists. But I consider Ruth Bader Ginsburg kind of the Thurgood Marshall of feminism, and somebody who saw something that was horribly wrong in America and didn't sit back, didn't say, I have a very, very comfortable upper middle class life, but said, I'm going to fight for justice. And she never stopped fighting for justice for all people, but particularly for equal opportunity for women. The one thing that I would, there's this kind of pop culture around RBG. I wish it was more focused on how far we've come since the 70s. You know, when I was a young child in the 60s and announced in the sixth grade that I was going to be a lawyer, I was laughed at. By the time I went to law school, a third of my law school class were women. That didn't happen by accident. That didn't happen because somebody gave up power. It happened because people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and leaders like Ruth Bader Ginsburg stood up and marched and marched into the courts and fought for equal opportunity. And so every professional woman who's in a veterinary program, who's in medical school, who's in law school, should take a moment and just thank, or who are in those professions, take a moment and thank people. Every woman who is still a stay-at-home mom who now has equal access to credit, who has the opportunity to raise their children in an equal relationship with their husband, take a moment and think about her legacy and think about what she gave this society, but gave those of us who came behind her kind of professionally and personally.
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree more. Absolutely. Unfortunately, Justice Ginsburg's last wish seems to not be honored by the Republicans. And so let's get a little bit into the dynamics of what's going on in the Senate. And let me ask you, has anything that's unfolded since Justice Ginsburg passed in the Senate side, has that surprised you at all?
No. You know, if they had been smart when they basically took a judgeship away from a wonderful and decent human being by the name of Merrick Garland, they should have said, we're going to do it because we can. And we always knew that was exactly why they were doing it. They were doing it because they can. And now you see the same kind of naked rush to power. But what's really tragic, and perhaps, you know, in addition to this huge titanic shift in the court and what could happen to the court, what's really tragic is what's this going to do to the Senate? And what is it going to do to the possibility of healing that institution and moving forward to guarantee the exercise of responsibility, not just power, but responsibility under Article 1. The one thing I do want to say about these senators now coming out, they're saying, we are going to approve the president's nomination. They don't even know who it is. I mean, if it were Mickey Mouse, I mean, you know, that is absolutely should give everybody pause in America that they are so quickly basically nullifying the responsibility that they have under advise and consent.
Right. Yeah, it's a total rush to judgment. It's unbelievable. So what do you think the calculations are on the McConnell side when they're trying to decide whether to call the vote before or after the election?
I think that he wants to do everything that he can to guarantee a very powerful turnout. The problem for McConnell is the Republican base for years, and especially the evangelical portion of the Republican base, the pro-life part of the Republican base, they've been turning out for years. They are already motivated. If, in fact, it's the only thing in many cases that motivate folks to vote Republican, especially folks who economically should be much more supportive of the Democratic Party. And so what this has done, and you can see it from at least what we're seeing now in terms of fundraising numbers, it has really energized the other side, who see now for the first time that they're, you know, when you look at Gorsuch replaced Scalia. You weren't going to get to the right of Scalia. And so that wasn't going to upset the power. When we saw Kennedy, you know, okay, that Kennedy being replaced by somebody who is more reliably conservative than Kennedy was, okay, that's a little shift to the right. And then Roberts moved into that space. Now we have a 180 degrees tectonic shift in the balance of power and the balance of ideology in the Supreme Court. And it is going to energize young people, especially young women. It's going to energize minority people who understand how critically important it is. It's going to energize so many of the people on the left. And so if you're McConnell, you know, you want to energize your base, but your base is energized. And I think, you know, Cory Gardner, I just don't see how he survives this. I don't see how, I mean, I think it makes things much tougher for Susan Collins. I think Tillis, you know, is on record saying, oh, I would never do this. I'm not a hypocrite. Yeah, really, you are a hypocrite. And so, you know, there is more potential damage to the Republicans than the Democrats, which is why he may want to do this very, very quickly and see if the subject gets changed between the time that they approve this justice and the voting ends.
Yeah, I think on the Senate side of the analysis makes sense that these senators who are up in these more swing state areas are a little bit between a rock and a hard place. I guess my question is, do you think that Trump is willing to sacrifice the Senate to get this confirmation through? That's one argument that I've heard. And, you know, his being a kind of selfish guy who only thinking of himself, you know, they're putting these senators in a really tough position.
You know, we've done a bunch of analysis at One Country, which I know you're familiar with. That is a C4 that I put together to kind of take a look at, you know, what is the political landscape and how important rural areas are to building a better base and a more stable base for the Democratic Party, in the Senate and basically to win. What we've seen is this trend that Senate races have become national races, and I think you see it right now in the commentary of people like Nate Silver. As goes the presidency, so goes the Senate. Unfortunately, when you look at places like Arizona, unfortunately for the Republicans, Arizona, Colorado, Maine, North Carolina, and even Iowa and Montana, you can see the energizing the more kind of progressive wing, and folks in the more Democratic leaning, progressive, green kind of area will not be good for Trump, and it won't be good for those Senate races. And so I expect that with very few exceptions, that you will see the population vote for Senate the way they vote for president. So the president is calculating that this is a win for everyone, not just a win for him. And you see that, you actually see that in what Tillis has been saying. The only person who has deviated at all has been Susan Collins.
So So then you don't think they're thinking they're going to lose the election?
I don't think they think. I think they think right. that this will dramatically improve their chance to win, because they will basically turn out evangelicals. And we've seen, you know, in a greater amount. I think that their calculation is more, do you vote before or after the election? And voting before may, in fact, depress kind of turnout for them. And so they may want to keep this in the public eye, but I think they're going to follow polling very, very close. And I want to caution everybody, they always want to point to what happened with Kavanaugh in 18. The thing about Kavanaugh in 18 was not just the replacement of a Supreme Court justice. It was the kind of debacle of the hearings. And I don't think anyone should be proud of how the hearings turned out, given how difficult that decision was, certainly for Dr. Ford, how difficult it was for her to come forward. And so I think it was, what I heard frequently on the campaign trail is, you're with the mob, because they saw these women who were still honestly suffering from post-traumatic stress and what had happened to them, coming forward and really being vocal and honest about their feelings, and it scared them. And so I think, depending upon how these hearings are conducted, I think that they are going to be very, very quick. I don't think there's going to be any deviation at all. And then they're going to have to decide whether they're going to, in fact, take that vote before or after. The risk is, if they take it after and there is a change in the Senate, they will look very, I think, inappropriate as it relates to what the people are saying.
Right. It's much harder to do what they want to do after the election if they lose it. Yeah, I totally agree with that. Let me just go back and pick up a little bit on the rural voters you mentioned and some of the research you've done. We've obviously done some research on these same folks at American Bridge. And, in the focus groups, one of the things that comes through, which you alluded to earlier, is that some of these white non-college educated voters are single issue. They are pro-life, and that's kind of determines what their vote is. And at the same time, 22% of the Trump voter in 16 was pro-choice. So specifically with the issue of abortion, how do you think that cuts? Is it a wash? Or what actually happens?
Well, let's go back, and the work that you're doing at American Bridge, and again, great, great, great work, especially in three swing states, and really appreciate everything you're doing to pay attention to rural America. You're one of the few, as we call them, independent expenditure organizations other than ours that is. And so you're a great partner. But I will tell you, in when I started out, I thought, let's win back the Obama Trump voter. That's my target. And one thing we've discovered in our polling is, as Reagan was able to attract what they called Reagan Democrats, I think Biden's able to attract Biden Republicans. And I think Republicans who are pro-choice, they're fiscally conservative and socially moderate, are really right now looking towards, kind of where's my home? Where do I go? If I still believe that women are that women have a right to decide what is going to happen with their reproductive freedom, and where do I go if I'm concerned about being fiscally conservative? And that's why I think it's really important that our message in these last final days be really geared towards the disgruntled or disaffected Republican who is in fact not socially on social issues conservative, but is much more moderate or almost liberal on social issues.
Right. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. So let's switch to the Democrats and talk a little bit about Democratic strategy here. Let's start with the near term. If you were running things, What would you suggest the Democrats do? There was an article in the New York Times the other day by former aide to Harry Reid suggesting that, everything be done in this very near term to kind of throw sand in the gears and delay the process as long as possible, with the idea that you put it into the lame duck. And it's harder, as we just said, in the lame duck, if they've lost the election, for them to do what they want to do. So what are some of the short-term sort of tactics that are available to the Democrats?
I think it is so limited. I think that they will wait out any time period the Democrats try and throw in there. And you know, obviously, you know, with the elimination of the filibuster, and we can talk about the wisdom of that one way or the other. But I think it's incredibly, if Mitch McConnell is hell-bent to do this, he's going to do it because he can do it. And so I think it's really important that the Democrats focus more on how important the court is rather than, you know, we're going to be the obstructionist party. I know there's radical, you know, the radical element of the Democratic Party is making an argument, but you know, when you don't have the power, you don't have the power. That the real argument that we need to be making is, if you don't want this to happen, you have to basically encourage us and vote for us. And so I think that if I were advising anyone, I would focus on the Texas decision in the Affordable Care Act. I would talk about the pandemic because they are joined at the hip. We see people with unequal healthcare opportunities being the most vulnerable during the pandemic. That's why the Affordable Care Act is so important. It provides that background. I would really, really focus on healthcare. I think that's going to pick up more swing voters, and do everything you can, but not create an expectation that you can stop this, because I'm not convinced you can. And I'm not the most educated in terms of the Senate rules, but I can tell you that where there's a will, there's a way, and he'll get it done.
Right. Let me just go back to something you said about the hearings. I think what you were saying was there's no way the hearings are anything but positive for the Democrats and probably negative for the Republicans. Could you expand on that a little bit? Because I've seen probably something taken out of context, but I've seen clips of the last confirmation round with Judge Barrett, and the Republicans are already trying to say that, Democrats are anti-Catholic. And so, you know, it seems to me they might have one, you know, sort of televised moment that, whether it's in context or not, they'll blow up, and it could be a plus for them. So what were you saying there exactly?
Well, what I'm saying is that these are performances, right, for the person sitting in the chair. And yes, you could say, okay, the questioning was anti-Catholic. And I think what's so funny is accusing Dick Durbin of being anti-Catholic when he is one of the more devout Catholics in the United States Senate, always is so incredible to me, when you look at kind of who they're accusing. And I would, if I can just take a moment, I would just tell people, I think you should all remember when Catholics were discriminated against, kind of marginalized, and how amazing it was in the 60s to actually have a Catholic president, because of the concern about the country will be run by the Pope as opposed by the president. And so, you know, we each take our turn. But I think that her performance in healthcare, the ability to ask her critical questions about, you know, where she sees judicial responsibility or power as it relates to reversing an act of Congress. If you're smart, you make the case on the First Amendment, but you focus on things like women's rights, because this is a replacement for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and you focus on healthcare, and you focus on executive power. And you know what? She hasn't been asked those tough questions. And to get her, you know, maybe she'll perform incredibly, or maybe she'll stumble. But, you know, that the rush to put her in center stage before with the big bright lights on may not be the best strategy for the Republican Party.
Right. So there's more upside and more opportunity for the Democrats, I think.
Yeah. I mean, you know, honestly, David, they already have the clips that they're going to run.
Exactly right? Right.
I mean, you know, so what else changes? What else changes?
So one other thing on Judge Barrett that I think might be interesting for our audience. One reads that, you know, she's been groomed for this position for years. By that, I think they mean groomed by the Federal Society and some of the right-wing infrastructure that exists around this takeover of the courts, the Judicial Crisis Network, and other groups. Could you just talk a little bit about that? Because I think our audience would find interesting the strategic kind of investment that the right wing has made going back, you know, really decades. And this seems to be, you know, this may be their moment.
Oh, it absolutely is their moment. This is the pinnacle. I mean, everybody looks at the last two judicial appointments, as I explained, you know, was a tectonic shift. You know, I want to point out that the irony that somebody who may in fact be sitting on the court is only there because of the incredible work of the people who came before us, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and they're being put there to undo everything that they did.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
I think that those kinds of emotional reaction that we have to that is a pretty powerful, not just a discussion point, but a pretty powerful kind of electoral motivation, especially for women my age. Women in their 60s who were given that opportunity. She's quite a bit younger than I am, which is another reason why they're picking her. But you know, all these women who now wield political or legal power are only there because of people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who said, "We don't live in an equal society and we're going to fight for equality."
In terms of the grooming and the strategic investment, it's often said, and I don't know if that's changing since 2016 or 2018, but that the right is more sort of politically invested in the issue of the courts, and it's more of a voting issue for the right than the left. Do you think that's right, correct? And do you think that that might be changing as more and more of these rights are threatened? Is there an opportunity for more organizing and activism on the more liberal side?
Yeah, I've said that over and over again, that the right has voted the court for years, in part because they see the court as having dismantled kind of the social structures that they find absolutely critical, whether that is looking at choice or whether that's looking at, you know, First Amendment issues, protest issues. I mean, they really see the court. And you know, the great irony of all that is that every time they think they have a champion on the court of their belief system, the law intervenes and people on the court actually implement the law and implement the Bill of Rights. And they're disappointed, right? Because the law is an ass. You know, you may disagree, but your response has to be changing the Constitution because these opinions are not incorrect. One of the issues that I would say that does not get as much attention, because we talk about healthcare and we talk about executive power and legislative power and what that looks like. The one thing that I would say heavily focused on corporations being people, you know, Citizens United, where the conservatives on the court coalesce is really in that lane. And so I would make an argument to every person who is a supporter of Senator Sanders or a supporter of Senator Warren who say, you know, we're too beholden to corporate America. This choice, this decision is as important as somebody who cares about choice. And so, you know, we need to talk about this decision in a broader context, including decisions like Citizens United. You know, corporations are people too, because some of this is really about reversing a case called Chevron, which is the oversight case. Which I always argue with, by that I mean regulatory oversight, whether you give deference to executive decisions. And I always laugh because I say, yeah, just like this court decision, now that Trump's made the executive decisions, you want all due deference to those. And so you might reverse your position. You know, we've got to have consistency in American law. There's got to be precedential value in order to give the certainty to the American people about what the law says. If you don't like it, there are means to change the law. But this decision, it's not just about, you know, the Federalist Society being concerned about gay marriage and you know, the Affordable Care Act. It also is about promoting pro-corporate kind of values that may not reflect individual liberties, whether it's for workers or whether it's for shareholders.
Yeah, well, that is a great point. And of course, Citizens United is definitely something worth bringing up for certain constituencies, because, you know, it's a little bit of a vicious circle, because so much of the dark money fuels these right-wing campaigns to take over the courts. So it's all related in a way. So I really enjoyed our conversation today, Senator. Thanks so much for joining us. I think that's a good note to end on. We look forward to having you on again. And for those who want more information on American Bridge, please go to AmericanBridgePAC.org. Check back for these podcasts and information about the upcoming election and how we're going to hold those Republicans accountable. Until next time, I'm David Brock. Thanks for listening to The War Room at American Bridge.